I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. When Joe Biden gets sworn in on January 20th, he'll be at 78, the oldest president in U.S. history. He's not alone when it comes to elders in government leadership. Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi is 80, while Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is 78. In fact, there are 23 senators in their 70s, 6 Republicans and 17 Democrats. Senators Grassley and Feinstein are both over 85. In fact, back in 2002, Strom Thurmond was 100 when he retired from the U.S. Senate. A recent article by Jane Mayer in The New Yorker about Senator Feinstein, quoting staffers and others saying she is not as mentally sharp as she used to be, has put a sharp focus on the age of our elected representatives. How old is too old? Why are so many seniors in Congress? How does the system favor the olds? Would we be better off with 40-somethings running the government? Is a discussion about older people ageist? We have two guests who have joined us. Alex Shepard is a staff writer for The New Republic. Alex, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's nice to be with you.
And joining us by Skype is Abby Keisha. She's deputy director of Tufts University's Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement, otherwise known as CIRCLE. Abby Keisha, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Good morning. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Alex, let me start with you. Are we living in a gerontocracy, and is that so bad?
I think it's pretty apparent that we are living in a gerontocracy. As you mentioned, congressional leadership of both parties, but especially the Democratic Party, is remarkably old, well above the retirement age. We just got out of a Democratic primary, or I guess it feels like we just got out of a Democratic primary in which the majority of the candidates were around 70 or older. We've just elected the oldest first-term president in the history of the country. And in general, the parties are both, membership of the parties in Congress is trending upward in terms of age and has been for quite a while. I think the question of is that a problem is a little more complicated. I think that there's nothing intrinsically bad about old people running the country, but I do think that what we've seen, particularly over the last 10 years or so, is party leadership that increasingly does look out of step with the actual membership of the party, particularly on the Democratic side.
Abby, let me get you in on the conversation. How do you see the fact that so many people who are older, beyond retirement, who are running our government? What does that tell us?
Well, thank you for including us in this conversation.
Absolutely.
We believe it's critical to strong democracy and strong communities in the U.S. to make sure that a diversity of people and a diversity of young people have pathways to contribute and lead. And there's running for office as well as a wide range of other types of engagement as communities that we can improve how equitably distributed these opportunities are. And this is critical to a diverse representative democracy and to strong communities. And currently, I believe we have processes and, you know, resource distribution that is designed for these outcomes to occur. We as a country can work to support increased youth representation, but that will take more commitment and less episodic attention to it, because this is a problem that's plagued our country for decades.
And I want to pick up on that. Let me go back to you, Alex, though. How much do you think incumbency sort of favors the fact that our system, our government system, especially in Washington, D.C., skews older, that once you're in office, you have the advantage of incumbency? You've got staff, you've got access to money, you have contacts. All of that sort of feeds the system that we're talking about.
Well, I think that if you look at Nancy Pelosi in particular, she has held on to power in exactly this sort of way, where she and her closest allies, Jim Clyburn, who's 81, and Steny Hoyer, who's 80, are, you know, they excel at this financial aspect of politics and making sure not only that they hold on to their seats, but also that other Democrats do as well. As you said, once you get in, you largely stay in. But Democrats, I think, have another problem here, which is that over the 8 years of the Obama administration, they were really wiped out at the state and local level. They lost, I think, something like 900 positions. And this bench has really proven to be a huge problem, where you've essentially lost a generation of Democratic politicians. The ones that we do see as sort of rising stars, Stacey Abrams, Beto O'Rourke, Pete Buttigieg are largely in red states and face a really difficult time to getting elected office.
Let me go back to you, Abby, and the obvious thing is to raise Senator Bernie Sanders. Ran for president two times, came pretty close, but the base of his support were young people. What does that tell us? And I'm also thinking of someone like Elizabeth Warren, both of, I believe she's 70, he's in his 70s. I mean, these are vigorous people that seem to have very sort of young, appealing ideas, certainly to a lot of younger voters.
Yes, that we saw a great deal of youth support for Senator Sanders in 2016, as well as the 2020 election. And this, I think, is exemplary of the fact that this issue of talking about age and gerontocracy is more complex than it may seem on from the surface. Because one of the things that we saw that young people were really supportive of some of the candidates you were talking about was because they agreed with them on issues. And this is illustrative of the fact that, you know, age isn't everything all of the time, and that this is really about a group of a larger group of dynamics, one element of which is age. It also involves values, what issues various elected officials or candidates are uplifting. And that is one thing that we've seen young people really, you know, be geared towards, really wanting to follow and support people who support the issues that they care greatly about.
Alex, let me go back to you. And it's so interesting that there's so many more older Democrats than Republicans. What does that tell us, especially in positions of leadership? But why does the, when it comes to leadership in Congress, why does that skew so much older for Democrats?
Well, it's interesting. You know, I was thinking about this before I came on, but I've written a ton of sort of Democrats in disarray stories over the last few years. But the one reason is that the Democratic Party has largely been more stable than the Republican Party, which has had kind of a number of purges, certainly since Newt Gingrich came to power, but also with the Tea Party in 2010, that people have been kind of flushed out. New Republicans have come in. With the Democrats, that hasn't really been true in the same way. That is a party that has, you know, changed ideologically much less than the Republican Party has. But also its leaders have largely just grabbed hold of power and held on to it. I mean, Mitch McConnell is the obvious counterexample for Republicans. But certainly in the House, you know, you've seen House leadership really turn over every 6 or 7 years.
I was reading an interview. I think Jay Mayer was interviewed on NPR about the pieces she had in the New Republic. And Alex, I'll toss this back to you. But she said one of the differences when it comes to leadership is that Republicans, I'm not sure if it's in the House and the Senate or both of them, they rotate leadership, whereas for the Democrats, it really is a seniority system that once you're the head of the Judiciary Committee, that's the job you stay as long as you're the majority party.
Right. And any effort to change that system is really met with fierce resistance within the party. You saw this with, you know, Sheldon Whitehouse, who's, you know, at the ripe young age of 65, tried to take on Dick Durbin for a whip position. Dick Durbin is 76. The party shut it down really, really quickly. This is, in general, a sort of rigidly hierarchical party structure, which, again, is ironic given the Democrats, you know, the fact that they're largely a more meritocratic and egalitarian party.
Abby Keisha, let me quote something that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez said recently, and I'm quoting here. I think there's a reckoning around the seniority structure here in the House that are probably overdue. The idea that we should be determining leadership predominantly or solely by tenure has been something that has been becoming increasingly under fire this term. And she goes on to there saying, you know, this system must be challenged. She's a very powerful voice in the House. Do you see an opportunity for some kind of reckoning?
I think one of the things that that quote really illustrates is the fact that this is bigger than a few individuals, that it really raises the question of how in our constitutional democracy do we maximize the relevant experiences that a wide variety and a diversity of Americans bring to governing and bring to making decisions for our communities. And I agree with her that tenure, you know, it shouldn't be the only thing that determines, you know, who has leadership ability, who has the relevant information to be able to bring to some of the critical questions facing our country.
I wonder, too, I mean, seniors are relatively reliable voters. Abby, I'm not sure exactly what the turnout was in 2020, but I do believe that more young people went and voted. I don't think it quite matches what seniors did. But how much does this, in a sense, become a self-fulfilling prophecy that if you vote, then you get the people and the issues that you want?
Thank you for raising that, because I do think that a lot of what we see is a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy. I mean, one of the unfortunate things with the way that our elections and voting systems are set up is that parties and candidates have incentives to reach out to people who have voted before, who have a vote history on a voter file, and less of an incentive to reach out to new voters, or maybe people who aren't, you know, the super voters. And so that's one thing that I think we can really change. We really have the knowledge to change that in this country right now. And as you say, could really change the policies that people are talking about, the way in which they approach governing, the way in which they approach talking to constituents.
Alex, let me go back to you and hear something. It was a Facebook comment from Kathy. She says, and she put this on our Facebook last night, how is a focus on age and not performance or ability, not ageism? And I don't see this as a discussion about ageism. I just think it's an interesting phenomenon that we have so many older people who are in very powerful positions in government. But, you know, how much do we focus on age and how much on performance?
Well, I think, you know, the biggest issue with particularly the Democratic House leadership is that these things are not tied together at all, that the seniority structure means that performance really isn't taken into account at all. One of the things that I think has really kind of haunted me since I read Jane Mayer's piece about Dianne Feinstein, Senator Feinstein, is that, you know, everybody in Congress knew that this was an issue going into, I think, the most important Supreme Court confirmation hearing probably of my lifetime. And yet, you know, it was never raised on the Democratic leadership, even with some younger members, somebody like Richie Neal, a fairly conservative, certainly to the right of most Democrats who chairs the House Ways and Means Committee. These are people that have held on to power despite not really reflecting the party itself. That is a larger issue, and I think it's one that requires shaking up for not only for the Democratic Party to actually look like its membership, but also for democracy to function properly.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation discussing whether the U.S. government is too old or what it says about our government that we've got so many people who are olds in positions of power. Alex Shepard is a staff writer for The New Republic. Abby Keisha is deputy director of Tufts University's Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement. And we want to hear from you. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're talking about why seniors are running the U.S. government from the White House to Congress, how the system favors older members, how younger ones can make inroads. Let me play a clip from Saturday Night Live. This is from November 11th, 2017, so a number of years ago, and it's titled Message from the Democratic Committee with Nancy Pelosi, played by Kate McKinnon, Dianne Feinstein, played by Cicely Strong, Chuck Schumer, Alex Moffitt, and Donna Brazile, Leslie Jones. Give it a listen.
You love our fresh new ideas delivered by fresh new faces like me, Nancy Pelosi.
And me, Dianne Feinstein.
And me, Chuck Schumer.
Y yo soy Tim Kaine.
And I'm team player Donna Brazile.
And we also have some great new leaders waiting in the wings, like hot young thing Elizabeth Warren. And also, that's right,
it's Biden time.
Abby Keisha, kind of dated, but also very current, correct?
Yes, in many ways.
Right, sort of eye rolling there. Picking up on what we were talking about before the break, broadly speaking, for younger people, for younger voters, Abby, what are the issues? I'm thinking of student debt. I'm thinking of a bunch of different issues that would really galvanize their involvement in politics. What are those issues you think that would help to sort of rebalance the system that we have?
Well, one of the things that we have seen, certainly over the past couple of elections, is that young people are able to lead and able to really raise issues to national conversations in a way that is really important and in a way that mobilizes other young people. In 2018, we saw this around gun violence prevention, and certainly in 2020, we've seen this around racial justice. And, you know, before the election, these were issues that we saw young people and heard young people saying were important to their vote in 2020. They also included healthcare. They also included climate. It is important to remember, though, that not all young people are liberal or progressive.
No.
There are actually millions of young people who voted for President Trump and think that President Trump is the best candidate to handle these issues. But the core piece of, you know, that I think is important here is that when candidates and when elected officials are talking about issues that affect young people's lives, that can really connect to young people. And that means that young people can understand, you know, why elections and voting are so critical. But one of the things, you know, connecting to one of the things that we were talking about before the break is that we need to have better incentives for parties and for campaigns to reach out to young people, to reach out to people who haven't voted before. Because otherwise we get into what you called the self-fulfilling prophecy, where we're talking about the same issues over and over again. And we've seen, of course, in 2018 and 2020, the way that young people have to, because they're not always included in a deliberate way, really just take space and take to the streets to raise up these issues that they care about. And young people shouldn't have to do that in order to talk about things that affect their lives, the people who they love, and affect their communities really dramatically.
Alex, let me go back to you and picking up on what Abby was just saying there, but also how is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, how is she viewed by the leadership in the Democratic Party?
Well, I think when you look at the campaign that Joe Biden ran for president, and I think which a lot of members of the House ran, it was sort of against Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, certainly against the sort of Bernie Sanders wing of the party. And since the election, that campaign has continued to rage on. Certainly there's been a lot of hand-wringing, a few sort of closed-door fights about the phrase defund the police, but Biden himself was also running, you know, against issues like the Green New Deal, against Medicare for All. I think that there's a real sense of anxiety and consternation among the sort of party's leadership about its, you know, I think both very exciting but also very polarizing rising young flank. I do think, however, that does obscure a larger issue, which is that, you know, down the stretch, you know, if you talk to some Democratic consultants, they will point to defund the police being damaging. However, you know, most Republican ads were about Nancy Pelosi. Similarly, the thing that you hear when you talk to a lot of Democratic ad makers and consultants is that the party's economic message was just not sharp enough to reach voters, that they ended up settling for this kind of milquetoast, middling message, and that hurt them. Whereas I do think, you know, AOC and others have found a new and more vibrant, in my opinion, economic message.
Here's a comment from, or a question actually, from Carol. She says, I do believe there should be age limit or term limits. Relationships are too entrenched after decades in Congress. Representatives worry about keeping their jobs versus serving their constituents. Abby, if I can go back to you, is that a piece of the puzzle that might solve, that might bring some more age balance to our government?
I do think that it's really important for us to be thinking about how do we set up a series of systems that promote a diversity of people running for office, a diversity of people thinking about these issues, because it is about who is elected. But it also is about what processes are used to determine what goes into legislation in a bill, who's being consulted. You know, there's young people right now really advocating the transition team to include more youth voice in the Federal Department of Education. These are really great ideas that we should be considering in addition to, you know, lots of other ideas that are out there as well to make sure that we're bringing all of the diverse experience to bear of Americans in this country to solving problems.
Alice, let me go back to you. And there are many, I think, explanations about how Joe Biden won the presidency. One argument could be that people in time, in this, you know, a pandemic and economic crisis and all the things that we're dealing with, that people wanted something that was familiar. This is a guy who's been in government for some 40, more, actually more than 40 years, actually began when he was 30 years old, and that they wanted something kind of familiar and maybe unexciting and moderate, and that explains why he got the job.
Yeah, I think, I mean, there are so many conflicting explanations for how Biden won at this point. I do think that that's one. However, what it also points to is the extent to which the Democratic Party is still being held together by, I don't even know if Joe Biden qualifies as a baby boomer. I think he's a little bit too old, but of one single generation. Now, you know, I think with Biden, his strength was that he was someone who was, his message was that he could hold together the diverse strands of the Democratic Party coalition in a way that no one else on, you know, those gigantic Democratic primary debate stages could. The question that Democrats, I think, really have to face very urgently, given the age of the party's leadership, is what are we going to do when these familiar, quote unquote, moderate faces are too old to run? That's going to happen. I mean, that should be happening now, in my opinion. It's certainly going to happen in 4 to 8 years. And I don't think that the party has come up with a reasonable way to promote younger leaders within the party. And it's going to be very damaging if they can't figure that out very quickly.
Here's a tweet from Nat. He says, yes, they're too old to evaluate their past and too insular to evaluate the present. He goes on to say, nobody over 50 should hold an elected office in this country. And that seems a little extreme, Nat, but I understand what you're saying. Here's a tweet from Downersville. What shocks me is how young the incoming right-wing leadership is, such as Holly, Cotton, and Cathorn. I wonder, Ev, if you could speak to that. As you mentioned, you know, young people have a diverse array of opinions. How different do you think the young people who voted for Trump and people like Trump versus Biden and people like AOC?
Well, I think what we're raising here is, do a broad diversity of young people really have an opportunity, really, and can really see themselves running for office? And, you know, there's groups more recently like the Millennial Action Project and Run for Something and many others who are trying to change this. But, you know, I think that we're really dealing with, as we talked about before, a self-fulfilling prophecy where, you know, we don't see a lot of young people, especially diverse young people of color, in lots of leadership positions. I mean, they're out there, but how can we elevate them more so that many more young people can see themselves in the political system? And how can we shift, you know, the resource needs, right, for running for office so that it's much more accessible and inclusive to the wide diversity of Americans?
How do we do that?
Well, one of the things that we would argue is that we have to, you know, we have to talk about whether and how we, you know, talk to young people about politics early on in their life. You know, there are ways to, you know, engage young people very early on in life, talk about democracy, talk about civic engagement. But unfortunately, too many of those opportunities go to wealthy school districts, more white school districts. And so as a way to bring more people into thinking about democracy, to thinking that their voice matters, that we have to start those conversations a great deal earlier, and certainly much earlier than 18.
That's Abby Keisha. She's Deputy Director of the Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement at Tufts University. Alex Shepard is with us. He writes for The New Republic. We're talking about how the U.S. government skews a bit older than the median or average age of the U.S. population. And you can join our conversation, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499. Alex, let me quote something that Paul Kane wrote in the Washington Post related to what we're talking about, quoting both Senator Charles Grassley, Republican of Iowa, and Patrick Leahy, a Democrat of Vermont. Grassley said, if I can run 3 miles 4 times a week, I'll be running for re-election. He said that now he's 87 years old. Leahy said, similarly, if I reach the point where I can't go scuba diving and do my somersaults, that will be one clear indication that it's time to not run for re-election. He's now 80. So this would be, you know, and he said this a couple of years ago in 2017. Yeah. Very interesting kind of physical criteria for whether you can run for office or not.
Yeah, I met Senator Leahy when I was 13. That was 20 years ago, and he seems old then. I think that, you know, I mean, with Grassley, I think it's also worth underlining that I believe he also said that he's only running 2 miles a day right now. I mean, it's certainly impressive for somebody in their late 80s. However, you know, there's just quite a bit of research that cognitive decline really does start to accelerate when people are in their 70s. I think that also, you know, I think culturally in this country, this extends beyond politics, both for economic and cultural reasons. People hold on, they work well past retirement age. I don't necessarily think that that's a sign of a sort of strong national fabric, but I also think that, you know, being able to pass the presidential fitness test even as a octogenarian, that shouldn't count for much in running for public office.
But Alex, the public get to vote people in and out of office. Now, I know incumbency does give people an advantage, but nonetheless, if the person you have doesn't represent you, I think Dingell was in for, what, 50, 60 years? Mm-hmm. You can just vote them out of office. Why isn't that our solution for bringing in some young, fresh blood?
Well, I think, you know, we have seen a huge increase, particularly on the Democratic side, of primarying, particularly, you know, sort of moderate voices who, in many cases, don't represent their districts the way that they might have 30 years ago. Elliot Engel, who was voted out this summer, is a sort of great example of that. But one big reason is that the party itself really, really, really hates primary campaigns run against its members. And with, you know, the case of the Democratic Party, they've gone as far as blackballing firms that work with primary candidates, even though, you know, for the most part, these firms have established that they're highly competent. That, I think, is a huge institutional barrier to this kind of change.
Here's a comment from Jake. He says, what young person can afford to run for office? I tried to. Someone said, who's going to support you financially? I don't have any money. Abby, how much is that part of the problem?
It's a huge part of the problem, and it's very real for these young generations who have been hit so hard economically over the past 10 years. And now we face, we're in the midst of a pandemic where 2/3 of young people, 18 to 29 years old, say that they've been either moderately or significantly economically affected. And so this is going to have implications for years to come. And so this is why we can't rely on individuals themselves having wealth to be able to run for office, and really raises the question, do these systems really serve a diverse and strong American democracy?
And you're saying they don't?
And I think that they really raise a lot of questions about whether or not these party systems, as well as the financial systems needed, are really going to bring in the younger candidates, the more diverse candidates. And there's some amazing groups really helping, you know, young people and new candidates hustle. But I also think that we have to look at the overall structure, because the United States deserves a representative and diverse democracy. And I think all of our communities will be better for it when we can achieve that.
You know, Alex, I'm thinking about the fact that President Trump was able to put three relatively young people on the U.S. Supreme Court. Amy Coney Barrett is 48 years old, replacing Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who was 87 when she died. These are lifetime appointments, but it does show you that, I mean, the president was thinking legacy for himself and legacy for the court in picking people who were young like that.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if we see somebody in their 30s on the court in my lifetime for this reason, that when it comes to appointments, particularly lifetime appointments, there's been a real arms race. Mitch McConnell has spent a great deal of energy making sure that the most important part of his legacy is putting young conservatives, many of whom are very, very far to the right of the American public, are given these appointments. One thing that's also, I think, worth underlining is that these Republican figures and the rising stars in the party, Madison Cawthorn's 25, I think Josh Hawley's in his early 40s, Marco Rubio's around 50. One reason that that works on the Republican side better than it does on the Democratic side is that the GOP, even with all its turmoil, remains a much more monolithic party than the Democratic Party. Democrats, meanwhile, have, I think, faced their own younger stars with a great deal of skepticism, in part because they're worried about being pushed too far to the left by progressives, even if these progressives represent the viewpoints of, you know, millions, tens of millions of young people.
Abby, we're almost out of time. Just final thoughts. I mean, we've been talking about what needs to change. Do you think we're going to, 4 years from now or maybe 2 years from now, will we see some progress on this front?
Well, from our 20 years of research on, you know, youth engagement in civic life and politics, I would argue that, you know, what we see relative to young people's involvement is more about access and less about apathy. In all of our research, we've seen youth interest, but a lack of encouragement, inclusion, and access to the processes and the systems to have their voices heard. And so I think that we'll continue to see, you know, folks like Representative Ocasio-Cortez and others. Right. But if we want to see much more than that, then we really have to change some of our systems.
Well, we have to leave it there. Abby Keesha, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And Alex Shepard, thanks for joining us as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Coming up, the backlash against an op-ed critical of Dr. Jill Biden's honorific doctor. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscoena, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. In an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, Joseph Epstein called on incoming First Lady Dr. Jill Biden to drop the honorific, saying it sounds fraudulent and comical. She has two master's degrees and an EdD from the University of Delaware and plans to continue teaching English at Northern Virginia Community College when she moves into the White House. Epstein kept on digging, beginning his piece, Madam First Lady, Mrs. Biden, Jill, kiddo, and ended with, forget the small thrill of being Dr. Jill and settle for the larger thrill of living for the next 4 years in the best public housing in the world as First Lady Jill Biden. Well, the backlash, as you can imagine, was swift. We asked Monica Hesse to join us. She's a columnist for The Washington Post, one of the critics. And Monica, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. And let me make sure our listeners can join us as well. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499. Monica, I mean, where to begin? But let me just start with a kind of broad-based question here. Do you think this was kind of a one-off from just a cranky guy, or does this reveal something larger about how women, especially women with advanced degrees, have been viewed?
I think that the reason that the column touched such a nerve is because it did strike a chord with a lot of female academics who are accustomed to having their degrees disregarded, who, even if they have PhDs, are referred to their students as Mrs. or Miss. So I think that any time a column like this has reverberations the way it did around the country, it's probably because it's striking at something that's pretty tender and meaningful to a lot of people.
What was most offensive to you?
I think that the last sentence that you read, which was the last sentence of his column, and actually not the sentence that offended a lot of people, was really distressing to me, because referring to her accomplishments as Dr. Jill as a small thrill and implying that it was a larger thrill to be the spouse of the president, I think that probably struck a nerve with a lot of women who fight to be recognized for their own accomplishments and their own hard work, and for the message to be that doctorate that you worked for years is a tiny thing, forget about it, just relax, enjoy being pampered and being the first lady, I think was really upsetting for a lot of people.
You said, actually, a funny thing. One of the things that Joseph Epstein said was that doctors are people who deliver babies. Yes, doctors do deliver babies, so do midwives and other people as well. But you write, if he wants to get technical about it, Biden did deliver a child out of her own uterus. I mean, getting a little pushback there, Monica.
It was just such a funny distinction. And I had people comment on my Facebook wall, I'm a dentist, I never deliver baby. Do I get to be called doctor? Or I'm a neuroscientist, or I have a PhD in chemistry, or even people who are in very specialized areas of medicine who don't deliver babies as part of their daily action. So I think that was, that was a little bit of a gimme. It's just such a ridiculous standard to place for who should get to be considered a doctor and who shouldn't.
Well, in fact, you looked up a doctor in Webster's, and the definition of doctor, I guess the Latin root of that, is teacher.
Well, what I think is really interesting is how much of this is cultural and historical. So, for example, in the UK, medical doctors are not referred to as doctor. Doctor in the UK is often reserved for people with PhDs, which is seen as a more prestigious degree in that it requires research, whereas in some countries, an MD is seen as a more practical degree in that it requires a lot of study and a lot of practice and a lot of training, but does not require independent research. So we could split hairs and we could argue about which has more value to society, which we should esteem more. But but the divisions that we've landed in are arbitrary here as they are elsewhere.
And we are talking with Monica Hesse. She's a columnist, writes for The Washington Post, responding to this op-ed in the Wall Street Journal that got a lot of play. A man named Joseph Epstein basically calling out the incoming First Lady, Dr. Jill Biden, for using the word doctor in her title. And again, you can join us, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499. You know, I have to say, even reading more of the article, he seemed to be denigrating not just teachers, but people that might teach at a community college, that somehow, you know, if it's not an Ivy League, and I might be reading too much into it, if it's not an Ivy League, there's something sort of less than, or having a doctorate in education is somehow less than. Can you speak to that, Monica?
I do find it interesting that the feedback that I got for the response that I wrote to Epstein was overwhelmingly positive, but the people who disagreed with me and who agreed with the Wall Street Journal column, their argument was overwhelmingly that she only teaches at a community college, and that must mean that she's not very talented because she couldn't get a job elsewhere, which is just sad on so many levels. Community colleges are the backbone and the bootstraps for thousands and thousands of Americans who use it as a stepping stone to higher education. It's the most accessible form of higher education that we have, and it's filled with hardworking students and teachers. And furthermore, I think it's a bit of a leap to say that Dr. Biden must teach at a community college because she can't teach elsewhere. In many respects, community college instructors are the most passionate about what they do because they are focused on teaching and not on the glorification that could come with an institution of higher learning. I think that Dr. Biden sees working at a community college as an act of service and an act of inspiration and a really important part to the educational system of America.
One of her former students, a woman named Nazila Jamshidi, she's now in graduate school at Georgetown at a piece in Business Insider. And this is Dr. Biden was her teacher. And this is what she said about her. She chose a teaching position at a community college where students with diverse backgrounds, students of color, financially disadvantaged students, immigrants, and non-traditional students make strides toward education and achieving their American dream. She joined a team of unique educators who fight every day to help guide students to a better future, and then talked about the leadership programs that Dr. Biden was involved in, just to kind of underscore what you were saying there. So Joseph Epstein got an earful. The Wall Street Journal defended him. Paul Gigot, he said, and I'm just looking for my little quote here so that I can say it correctly, but essentially said, if you disagree with Mr. Epstein, fair enough. This is Paul Gigot. Write a letter or shout your objections on Twitter, but these pages aren't going to stop publishing provocative essays merely because they offend the new administration or the political censors in the media and academia. What should be done, or what should be said, or what would you say to Joseph Epstein?
Well, I think that it's a little bit disingenuous to say that the backlash came because it was somehow steered by the new administration or steered by a few other people in media. The emails that I received in response to my column, and I've received hundreds, some of them were from women in fields we would consider elite, women with PhDs from Harvard or Yale who had struggled to receive the same respect and recognition as their male colleagues. But many of them were from women who work in predominantly male industries like construction or manufacturing or who work in blue-collar service jobs. And they talk about also struggling to receive the same respect, whether it comes in the as a title, whether it comes in the form of a promotion, or whether it comes in the form of how they are treated in their daily life. So I think that women are able to recognize sexism, whether it happens at a PhD level or whether it happens at the restaurant where they are washing dishes or the plant where they are making parts. I think that it strikes a nerve because this is not about academia. This is about wanting the same recognition and respect for the work and hours and training that you have put into a job you're dedicated to.
But do you think criticism of Joseph Epstein is enough? I mean, does something else need to be? I'm not sure. He's an older gentleman, and I'm not sure, you know, what his occupation is these days. But should someone lose their job over something like this?
I think that, rather than talking about who should lose their job and who shouldn't, I think that what this should make the journal aware of is that there's a difference between a column that provokes spirited discussion and a column that is just outdated and wrong. And this viewpoint did not seem provocative and provoking discussion. It seemed provocative in the sense that it was a throwback to views of 50 or 60 years ago, which hopefully we have moved past as a society. And I think that is where the nuanced discussion happens. Are we publishing things that prompt discussion because they are nuanced and they are interesting and there are worthy debates? are we just publishing things to poke people in the eye that really are settled matters that don't need to continue to be debated in discourse?
Let me read a couple of comments. One from Bob. He says, to be honest, I think anyone insisting to be called doctor outside of a professional context is pretty weird, medical doctors included. It seems like trying to enforce some kind of hierarchy over those around them who didn't happen to get higher degrees. A comment from Bill. I don't understand why calling Dr. Biden by her title is controversial. The Trump people were constantly inflating their credentials that they didn't have and going on saying that Melania has a degree in architecture. A comment from Kate. This all has to do with the fact that Dr. Biden is a woman. It's about men fearing that they are losing the power grip that they have had on work, politics, and et cetera. An email from Beverly. So many of us have experienced Joseph Biden's of the world. I, too, have two masters and a PhD, also from the University of Delaware, and regularly have men with less education pontificate to me and assume just because they're men, they are superior. In Delaware, we're proud of Jill, our Dr. Biden. Just a kind of a smattering of response. How many responses did you get to your piece, Monica Essie?
Oh, as I said before, I mean, in the hundreds, there, I think in the time I've been sitting here with you, I'll probably log off and have 10 or 12 more. It's really been a topic where a lot of people want to share their own experiences and their own thoughts. And I would say that the ones that your listeners just sent in are really representative of the wide range of responses that I've gotten as well.
Do you think we can grow from this or learn something from this?
I think that anytime we have a discussion like this, we can grow and learn from it. I mentioned in my column that I had spoken with female academics whose students defaulted to calling them Mrs. and defaulted to calling their male professors doctor. And then I heard from male professors who said they had no idea that was happening and that they would now try to do their part to make sure that students referred to their female colleagues with the titles that they deserved. So I think that anytime something like this happens, it can work as a bit of consciousness raising, and we can all become a little more aware of what people whose experiences are different than ours are in fact experiencing every day.
I thought it was interesting that Dr. Jill Biden tweeted, "Together we will build a world where the accomplishments of our daughters will be celebrated rather than diminished." And I'm almost hesitant to quote Tucker Carlson, but apparently he said on his TV show he likened her doctorate to Dr. Pepper. Dr. Bill Cosby, of course, played a doctor on TV. And even Joseph Epstein apparently has an honorary doctorate, but he somehow seemed to equate his honorary doctorate with her doctorate that she earned at the University of Delaware.
Yeah, this I can't really explain it. It was very baffling to me how many people seemed to think that Dr. Biden's doctorate was honorary or not real, or they didn't understand what an EDD was. A lot of people were saying, well, you should only get to have a doctorate if you've done independent research. But she has. She had to publish a dissertation that required independent, original research. So I think that for whatever else we can say about the column, and Epstein's ideas, it was actually just a poorly written column because its arguments were not very sound, and they sort of didn't follow. He seemed to be conflating honorary degrees with earned degrees, and not really certain of what an EDD was. So I think that people are just in general not really understanding the issues at play.
Well, I appreciate you joining us, Monica Hesse. Thank you so much. Thanks for joining us today in Radio Times.
Oh, anytime. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And she writes for the Washington Post, and it looks like we will have a working First Lady. First Lady Dr. Jill Biden plans to continue teaching English at Northern Virginia Community College, a job that she has had for a number of years now. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show and, of course, find us on Facebook. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.